54342, Leonard Hill versus State. Ms. Conway for the petitioner, Mr. Tomczyk for the respondent.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Audrey Conway, and along with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, I represent Mr. Leonard Hill. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. This case is a direct appeal of a first-degree murder conviction after a jury trial. This court previously reversed Mr. Hill's first conviction after trial as a result of discovery violations and several instances of prosecutorial misconduct. Mr. Hill's case is not one with overwhelming evidence of first-degree murder. Mr. Hill and the deceased, Ms. Martin, had an on-again, off-again relationship over several years. By December of 2005, things had deteriorated between them. Ms. Martin changed the locks on their apartment to keep him out. When he tried to get in, she called the police. They advised her she would have to legally evict him and that she could not simply change the locks. The two continued to argue, and things came to a head on December 11th, 2005. A neighbor overheard Ms. Martin threaten to kill Mr. Hill. More arguing occurred that night. By 12:45 a.m. on December 12th, Mr. Hill had borrowed a neighbor's telephone to call 911. He said he was just trying to sleep, that he was being harassed, and he asked a second neighbor to call 911 for him. Ms. Martin also asked a neighbor to call 911. Officers came out and spoke with both parties. They advised them to stay apart for the remainder of the evening. They found no evidence that either party was a threat at that time to the other party. Unlike most domestic violence calls, officers determined that no threat existed and made no arrests. Officers cleared the call and left the apartment at 1:22 a.m. Neighbors almost immediately heard more yelling, a banging sound, a scream, and a crash. Downstairs neighbor Juliana Gross called 911 again at about 1:39 a.m., less than 20 minutes after officers had initially left the apartment. Gross said to the 911 operator, "It sounds like she's banging the door in," although she would later change that to "he's banging the door in." Officers arrived for the second time at 1:43 a.m. Mr. Hill opened the apartment door just after 2. Officers found Ms. Martin's body in a bedroom and could not get a pulse. Officers found a bloody knife. Mr. Hill had stab wounds on his arms that later required stitches. He was arrested and placed in handcuffs. Because of the history of arguments, inflamed passion, and hostility on both sides, and because of the evidence of provocation, self-defense, and heat of passion, this case should not have resulted in a first-degree murder verdict. And the closeness of this case makes any evidentiary errors in the court's ruling all the more significant and all the more prejudicial.
But aren't these jury questions that you raise as to, you know, we charge open murder in these particular cases, and then it's up to a jury rule to determine whether there was premeditation and deliberation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And regarding the sufficiency of the evidence issue, what I'm trying to suggest to this court is that when you have a case where the evidence is close and there's a significant amount of evidence of self-defense, provocation, heat of passion, it frames all of the other evidentiary rulings in a different way. This is not a case of overwhelming evidence of first-degree murder. And that's why every error that the trial court made became so significant. The primary issue I'd like to address with this court is the district court's refusal to allow the defense to call the lead detective on the case as a witness. A key component of the defense theory of this case was that officers rushed to the conclusion that this was a first-degree murder, and therefore they failed to thoroughly collect and investigate all of the evidence at the crime scene. The right to present a complete defense to the jury hinges upon the right to cross-examine and confront government witnesses. How a witness responds to cross-examination is the main criteria upon which jurors can evaluate credibility, weigh competing evidence, and find facts supporting guilt or innocence. In Chambers versus Mississippi, the United States Supreme Court described the right to present a complete defense as among the most fundamental rights in our legal system. In Duncan versus Louisiana, the court recognized that the judgment of a jury was a key safeguard against overzealous prosecution and compliant judges. At the first trial, Detective Anderson testified regarding her decision to test some evidentiary items for DNA, but not others. The defense used her decision and her decision-making process as support for the defense theory that this case was not competently or adequately investigated by the police. Prior to the second trial, the state decided to request testing on the items that had not been tested prior to the first trial. The state explicitly assured the defense that the state planned to call every witness who had been called at the first trial, and that the defense could rely on the state's subpoenas so that we wouldn't have to send our investigators out to subpoena the same witnesses who were already on the state's list. So we relied on both of those assurances, and these facts are not in dispute. However, on the fifth day of trial, the defense was informed for the first time of two things. First, that the state, after all, does not intend to call Detective Anderson. And second, that the state was now objecting to the defense, relying on their subpoena and calling Detective Anderson. The state took the position that it was unfair for the defense to highlight the delays on the DNA testing for some of the evidentiary items. The state argued that because Mr. Hill had been incarcerated between his conviction in June of 06 and this court's reversal and remand in June of 08, the state had no reason during that time period to conduct that testing, and only did so after the reversal. The state insisted that any mention of a delay in the DNA testing would open the door to advising the jury that there had been a previous trial and that Mr. Hill had been convicted of first-degree murder in that previous trial. The state insisted that no other explanation would remedy the inherent prejudice to the state from the defense exploring these delays. The court then required the defense to make an offer of proof regarding Anderson's anticipated testimony. Defense counsel noted that we were entitled to cross-examine Anderson because she made specific statements in 2006 regarding her decision-making process about which evidentiary items to test and which ones she would not test. And I quote, "DNA requesting would have been redundant and very time-consuming, very complicated, very long process. The DNA testing and the DNA fingerprinting and such. So we decided that it was not necessary in this case." This court must reject the state's position that Anderson's testimony would have necessarily implicated the first trial and the result of the first trial. Both parties could have referenced Anderson's testimony from a prior hearing without specific reference to the first trial, as we did so with many other witnesses. Had the court been inclined to craft a less draconian ruling, the state could have even explained that prosecutors did in fact order the DNA testing after a prior hearing. They could have even told the jury that it was in response to defense criticism of the police investigation. That would have been more fair. The court could have even placed parameters on the defense argument. The court could have advised the jury, after taking judicial notice, that some of the delays were not attributable to the state, but were the result of procedural delays. Any of these rulings would have been more fair and more equitable than the complete exclusion of this witness. Mr. Hill's conviction was reversed and this case remanded in June of 08. The DNA testing was not done until May of 09. At minimum, the defense should have been free to highlight the initial decision not to test that DNA in 05 and 06 and to explore why it took another year to eventually test the DNA before the second trial. Any other ruling would have been more fundamentally fair than the categorical exclusion of a witness based on the state's creation of this false dichotomy to the effect that any reference to testing delays would open the door to the result of the first trial.
Help me understand how this would help you as to whether it was first degree or second degree.
Our position is that because this was a very close case.
In your opinion.
Detectives.
In your opinion.
Granted, but I think the evidence also supports that. Mr. Hill had stab wounds that required stitches. His blood was ultimately found on the knife. You know, one of the many comments he made was that it was self-defense after officers took him into custody.
We noticed his comments, by the way, which are detrimental to any defense.
Some of them absolutely are.
If I can just put up about the comment, because I had the same question just as Cherry just asked, but I think he made the comments, if I wrote them down here, that Mr. Hill allegedly said he took her ass out and snapped. He hoped she died. He would plead temporary insanity. Sounds like a lot of first degree type.
He did say some dreadful things, but I would note for the court that this was after the event and that those are really not evidence of his mindset before the event. And he was all over the place. He said numerous different things, and one of them was that he acted in self-defense and that she came at him. So I think that we do have a mixed bag there, but he did have stab wounds. His blood was found on the knife. We have seen cases with certainly significantly less evidence of self-defense than this one. But our key point is that our theory of the defense was that the detectives conducted that analysis at the very beginning of the case. They decided in a kind of rush to judgment that this guy was going down for first-degree murder. In Holmes versus South Carolina, the United States Supreme Court found reversible error in the exclusion of third-party guilt evidence, not only because the defendant was prohibited under a state rule from admitting this evidence because it was exculpatory, but the court also found error in the exclusion of this evidence because it precluded Holmes from making a powerful case of witness bias against the police officers, who directed their focus entirely on him to the exclusion of other suspects.
Did you get an instruction on self-defense in this matter?
We did.
And you got an instruction on voluntary manslaughter?
We did.
And you got an instruction on second-degree murder?
We did.
It's one thing when we second-guess judges. It's another thing when we try to second-guess juries, when they've had that opportunity to acquit because of self-defense, or find voluntary manslaughter or second-degree murder in this case.
We understand.
Understand our position as an appellate court.
Absolutely. However, preventing us from exploring this area means that Mr. Hill was essentially punished for winning his first appeal, because an avenue for us that was open at the first trial was shut down for us at the second trial. And that is something that should not have happened. Anderson had already admitted that although Mr. Hill had stab wounds, although he was clearly the victim of a knife attack, the police deemed it unnecessary to even test that knife for his blood when they were conducting the initial investigation. Although the testing ultimately occurred, the court prevented us from using these admissions at the first trial to buttress our defense theory that the police ignored evidence of self-defense in their rush to convict a man whom their own officers had deemed no threat to Ms. Martin only 20 minutes before the killing. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
You have about 3 minutes and 50 seconds.
Thank you.
Mr. Tomczyk, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
May it please the court, my name is Josh Tomczyk. I am a chief deputy district attorney in the Clark County DA's office, and I am the prosecutor who was responsible for the prosecution of this case from the time Mr. Hill was originally charged with murder in December of 2005. I prosecuted the case at the first trial in June of 2006, and I prosecuted the case at the second trial in June of 2009. The defense, the appellant essentially brings to this court's table their opinion that this isn't a case of first-degree murder, and I'll quote what was just said. There is no clear evidence of first-degree murder. This case should not have resulted in a verdict of first-degree murder, and this is not a case of overwhelming evidence. I would point out to the court partially some of the statement just made by Justice Cherry, and that's this. This is a case that went to a jury, not once, but twice. 24 individuals, as a fair cross-section of society, have found that this case should be a first-degree murder. The question before your honors this morning is whether or not there was something done in this second trial that tells the 12 people who were the jurors in that case that they were wrong. Part of the frustration, and the reason I point out to this court that I was the trial prosecutor at the second trial, is because oftentimes there is a large disconnect between what happens within the four walls of a courtroom at trial until what appears on the four corners of a brief in front of justices such as yourselves. The entire argument that was focused on by the appellant a moment ago, that Detective Anderson was precluded from testifying at the second trial, is 100% completely wrong. The district court in no way precluded Detective Anderson from testifying. The district court had brought to their attention by the state of Nevada that the defense had requested that they be allowed to utilize the subpoenas issued by the state to all of the notice state's witnesses. I informed the defense that I would have no problem doing that. Should they intend to call any of the witnesses on our witness list, I would make sure those witnesses were available at the time they requested in the courtroom. What happened during the trial, however, is from the inception of the opening statement by the defense, the trial prosecutor for the defense, Timothy O'Brien, the deputy public defender, attempted to utilize the date of the distribution reports on the DNA analysis as if somehow to argue the police in this case didn't do their job. They didn't request that DNA be done until 2 weeks before trial. He attempted to make that argument, knowing full well that the reason that wasn't done until 2 weeks before trial is because up until that point, it wasn't necessary because the defendant was in Nevada State Prison convicted of first-degree murder. I brought it to the court's attention at trial because not only did Mr. O'Brien reference it in his opening statement, but he attempted to actually introduce the DNA police reports into evidence during the cross-examination of the DNA analyst, Kelly Gauthier, into evidence to show when those reports were done. When we asked the court for an offer of proof as to why Detective Anderson would be called, it was in order to prevent the defense from again going down that line of questioning, which they had twice before been prevented from doing so, appropriately so. When asked to make an offer of proof, I asked that the court require the defense to make an offer of proof. The court asked the defense if they'd be willing to do that, and Mr. O'Brien said he would. His offer of proof was that he would call Detective Anderson to ask those same types of questions. The court precluded him from doing that, not from calling Detective Anderson. To say that the court disallowed her to be called to trial is completely untrue. If the court looks at the record, it's the fifth day of trial, just after the testimony of Detective Todd Williams, when the state is about to rest and we're introducing this evidence. It's at 1277 of the appellate's appendix. This is when this exchange takes place. At the conclusion of that exchange, the court actually says to Mr. O'Brien, or the state actually brings it up, at page 179 of the transcript, 1295 of the appellate's appendix. Just so the records are clear, I'm assuming, I don't know, are they going to call Laura Anderson because I need to know so we can make arrangements? Mr. O'Brien says, no, I can't get to the relevant part of her testimony, so he indicates I'm not going to call her. That is his choice. The court then says, right, he's not doing a very good job so far of practicing being nice. They said they didn't want her to be here in light of the court's ruling, that they would like to have her testify, but they have nothing to ask her in light of this court's ruling. State responds, very well. They had an opportunity to call her to ask her the same questions they did at the first trial. They had an opportunity to ask her types of questions involving her investigation. The appellant a moment ago also said that at the first trial, Detective Anderson testified that she had requested certain items of evidence to be tested for DNA. That's also not the case. At the first trial, the sole purpose in calling Detective Anderson was so that she could explain to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury why she hadn't submitted items of evidence for DNA testing. It wasn't done, and that was a huge part of the defense at the first trial. Subsequent to that, when the case was remanded by the Supreme Court and we were facing a second trial, the state decided to alleviate that argument. So the jury could understand what exactly transpired in that apartment at the time the homicide occurred, and so that the jury could make an informed decision about whether this was or was not self-defense, the state submitted all of the items available for DNA testing. The defense was then left with what was there. The reason the court in this case decided not to allow Detective Anderson to testify about the fact that such a time period transpired between the murder and the time when the DNA testing was ultimately done was for three reasons. It was unfair, and it was unfair no matter how that ruling came down from the court. If the court allowed that testimony to take place without giving the state a chance to respond as to why, because the defendant was in prison for a first-degree murder conviction, well, that was fundamentally unfair to the state. That should be obvious. If the court allowed that testimony to come in front of a jury without having the jury be allowed an opportunity to have explained to them why it took so long, that was unfair to the trier of fact making a determination about what was done during the investigation. It was unfair to the jury. And most importantly, and we discussed this ad nauseum in the record, by disallowing the defense to ask Detective Anderson those types of questions, why did it take so long for this DNA testing to take place, it protected the rights of the defendant. And this was an issue raised by the state, because inevitably what would have occurred had that line of questioning been allowed to go down is there would have been questions appropriately raised as to how long it took and why it took so long for that testing to be done. There would have been questions raised about the fact that the defendant refused a buccal swab and had to be compelled to do so in open court. And there would have been questions asked about the fact that he had previously been convicted and was in custody. It would have been absolutely unfair to the defendant to allow those types of questions to be asked. So the reason I bring all that to the court's attention at this point is because there was a very clear record made, and it's a record that took place over approximately 20 pages of a transcript at trial about what was and was not allowed in terms of the testimony of Detective Anderson and why it wasn't allowed. Had the defense chosen to call Detective Anderson for a different purpose, they would have absolutely been allowed to do so. Had the defense wanted to call Detective Anderson for anything absent that narrowly tailored restriction by the court, they certainly would have had the ability to do so, and the state would have made
it. Mr. Thomas, in the second trial, did Judge Leavitt allow the jurors to ask questions of the witnesses?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Also, as far as the jury, they were told that there was a knife involved. They knew there was a knife.
They were.
They knew that it was his blood on the knife.
They were. They were aware of that.
And there was an argument about self-defense.
Judge, all of the instructions requested by the defense, with the exception of one, which was an incorrect statement of law, nowhere in any case precedent regarding strangulation were provided to the defense. They requested the Runyon instructions related to self-defense. They were given all of those instructions. They requested a manslaughter instruction. They were given manslaughter instructions. They argued to the jury that this was a case of self-defense. They argued to the jury that even if they didn't believe that this was a case of self-defense, that it was a case of voluntary manslaughter. They were provided with all those instructions. They were not restricted from making any of those arguments. The jury heard all of that evidence. The jury also heard evidence regarding Mr. Hill and how previous to the call out when the actual homicide happened, the earlier call out that same evening, he had told the police that she had struck him. He had set up his own story and then later recanted that and admitted that it wasn't true, that he had made it up to make it look like she was the initial aggressor. They heard that evidence. So they heard the evidence regarding self-defense at that time. They heard the evidence regarding self-defense as it related to the knife, the homicide, how that occurred, where the blood was found within the apartment, what the percipient ear witnesses downstairs below heard at the time the murder took place, the 19 minutes that patrol officers knocked on the door attempting to get into that apartment. They heard all of that evidence, and they made the conclusion that this was a case of first-degree murder.
What was there evidence presented as to Mr. Hill's height and weight compared to Ms. Martin's height and weight?
That was an area that the defense went into early and often in the trial, remarking that Robin Martin was a woman of good size. She was 245 pounds at autopsy. Mr. Hill, at the time of that he was taken into custody, was 6'2", 265 pounds, and the jury heard all of that evidence.
Okay, thank you.
I see I have some time left, but if there's not any questions.
Justice Pickering, do you have any questions?
I don't.
Justice, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Ms. Conway, rebuttal. You have 3 minutes and 50 seconds.
Yes, I don't anticipate meeting the length you gave today.
You heard about that, huh?
Thank you, Justices. The state, of course, emphasizes that 24 individuals convicted Mr. Hill of first-degree murder. It probably goes without saying. First trial doesn't count. It was riddled with unfairness. It was reversed for good, solid, sound reasons. And this court should not be remotely swayed by the fact that this was a second jury. Second, the only things we wanted to ask Detective Anderson about related to the DNA testing. There was no other reason to call her. This is the whole theory of the defense, that the detectives made a rush to judgment, that they didn't adequately investigate the case, and Anderson was our key witness in terms of exploring that type of evidence. We were not able to explore this in a meaningful fashion with the other witnesses. We did cross-examine the crime scene analysts, and the other colleague detective, Detective Williams, also testified about the investigation, but he was in charge of taking Mr. Hill into custody. He wasn't even in the apartment. He wasn't in charge of the crime scene evidence collection. He wasn't in charge of that decision-making process. The crime scene analysts, of course, are directed what to test and what not to test, and it was Detective Anderson who made those decisions. So although we did explore some of this with the other witnesses, we were not able to do it in the meaningful fashion that we would have been able to explore with Detective Anderson. And yes, the police didn't do their job. There's a bloody knife found in a murder scene and they decide not to test it. When there is even a colorable claim of self-defense, we would argue that that was sloppy police work, that it was because they had already made their decision about who was responsible and who was guilty and who wasn't, and we were fully entitled to explore that on cross-examination. There was no other reason to call Detective Anderson but for this testimony.
Did the defense attorney argue there was sloppy police work aside from the fact that Anderson didn't testify?
We did explore the fact that some of these items were never tested and were permanently lost, but it was Anderson who made the initial statements about the reasons why DNA testing just wasn't worth it. We were entitled to cross around that. We were entitled to say, you said in 2006 that it was too time-consuming and too difficult, but ultimately you made it happen within a month when the state requested it. It had to do with that initial investigation and the mindset of the police at that initial investigation. And those are the exact same things that the Supreme Court in Holmes versus South Carolina found to warrant reversal. The court's refusal to allow the defense to call Detective Anderson violated the Sixth Amendment right of confrontation under Chambers v. Mississippi and under Pointer v. Texas. The denial or significant diminution of this right requires close examination of the competing interest that is advanced. In this case, the competing interest of the alleged unfairness to the state fails to overcome the denial of access to a key witness in a key area that was integral to the defense. Because we were prohibited from testing Anderson's recollections, probing the details of her decision-making at the outset of this investigation, and testing the accuracy, credibility, and veracity of her testimony before the jury, the defense would urge this court to find a lack of integrity in the fact-finding process and to reverse and remand this case for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
The panel thanks both counsel for their arguments in this matter. When I saw who was arguing this case, I knew that I suspected it would be good argument, and you lived up to my expectations, both of you. Congratulations to both sides on your presentation. Briefs were good, and this case will stand submitted, and this panel is now in recess until the call of the court.